The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 12th of June, 2020. On the podcast today, Clive Beattie, Acting Chief Executive Officer of On The Market. And Clive discusses their recent final results and outlook going forward. Also on the podcast, Dan Betts, CEO of Hummingbird Resources. And Dan discusses their recent acquisition and group strategy. Plus, Dr. Hugo Stevenson, CEO of Induction Healthcare, INHC is their ticker. And Dr. Hugo explains the business and outlines the potential in the health tech sector. And Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about banks and the underperformance of the UK banks. And Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, talks about the market, what he's been buying and selling, Roslyn Data Technologies, and On The Market as well. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. You can see both these, top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a whole host of other content, and check out our COVID-19 index right there at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Clive Beattie, Acting Chief Executive Officer of On The Market. OTMP is the ticker there. Clive, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure. Good morning and very glad to be here.
Yeah, well, you just released your financial results there. And we'll go through that and we'll touch on the business as well. Before we do, I'm sure people have seen the adverts, they know the brand quite well. But if anyone out there hasn't heard of you, can you just briefly summarise On The Market? What's it all about, please, Clive?
Of course. On The Market is a market-leading UK property portal. And what we do is connect our customers, who are agents and new homes developers, who pay us to advertise the properties they have of vendors and landlords. And we market those through onthemarket.com. The millions of consumers that visit our site, and they represent the buyers, the tenants, who are interested in connecting with those properties. Our origins are as an agents mutual. We were set up by agents to bring competition and choice into the portals market. It's been a difficult time because as a challenger, obviously that's hard going, hard graft. But actually after much time and money, we think we're now there. We've achieved the critical mass that's important for a portal. And part of that has been on the back of, you know, very strong agent support, which we've enjoyed because of our origins. We have a differentiated proposition. We are have over 3,000 agent shareholders. They hold over 6,000 branches between them. And they own about 65% of the company still. So that sets us apart, I think, from others. And clearly, the agent's content is key to this, the success of any portal. And finally, they also do things for us that are a bit different. We have something called New and Exclusive, where properties from some of our agents, they load up to us before they put them on any other portal, and therefore offer the serious buyer who wants to see properties as soon as they come to market. That's a compelling reason to sign up with On The Market and look at the properties via our website.
Do you know what? I've got to admit, that is the reason why I got the app. When I said sometimes we get properties before they're even listed, I've only got two apps now, and people know the right move is, for instance, the dominant market player there, and your app. And that convinced me. Now, you have about, 8,000 branches under paying contracts as of the 31st of June, so it's all about sort of scale, I suppose. How important is that scale, and how big do you need to get?
I think scale is very important because if you think about it, if you are an advertiser, you want to pay to reach a wide audience. So if we don't have a lot of consumers, then that's not of interest to the advertisers, to be our customers. But at the same time, there's no point having lots of consumers and no content for them to view. So you need both. And it's actually trying to kickstart that virtuous circle that is takes the time and money. I think actually we're there. You know, we're not as big as the market leader, obviously. But actually, we've achieved significant scale. So currently, end of May, we had over 13,600 advertisers. We're having some record months in January. We had over 30 million site visits to the sites and its apps. Actually, a couple of days ago, we had a record day of leads. And leads are where people connect. So a buyer might then get in touch with an agent about a property, and that represents a lead. The leads are what the agents are after from advertising on the site. And as I say, we've been having record days there. So I think over the course of the financial year to Jan 20, our year end is 31st of Jan 20. We saw a significant increase, 32% increase in the advertisers listing with us, a 49% increase in the traffic we get from consumers, and that led to a 75% increase in the leads we're delivering back to our agents on average per month.
Yeah, yeah, and obviously your model is agent ownerships and the agents hold stocks, most of them or some of them. So what edge does that give you in the market then, Clive?
Well, ultimately, agents can make or break a portal. You know, an agent, it is that content that we market to consumers. So you can imagine if we didn't have any content at all, I mean, we wouldn't have a portal. So really, it's the choice of agents which portals they their properties on to market that you know ultimately determines the success of the portal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
so you know, having such a large shareholding base, I mean, I mentioned over 6,000 branches in their agent shareholders' hands. Just to give some context, we think there's probably around 18,500 branches, agency branches in the UK. So that's roughly a third of the agency market that are directly invested in us and aligned with our financial investors in making the portal a success.
Yeah, yeah.
We also hope, sorry, I was going to say, Justin, one of the other unique things we have authority to issue more shares. So we have another 30-odd million shares that we can issue to new agents who join us and want to join as shareholders as well and participate in the growth in their own portal.
Understood. Okay, so you mentioned the results just out. So take us through, just go to summary of those, if you could, revenue, et cetera, Clive, and whatever you want to highlight there.
Yeah. So revenues grew 30-odd% in the year, up 32% to 18.8 million. Our model when we came to market, we listed on AIM in February 18. Our model was very much one where we wanted to get the scale that I've just talked about. That's a crucial waterfall. So actually revenue in the first instance wasn't the key aim. We gave a lot of free listings to agents just to get the scale on board. And then the money we raised when we came to market, we spent on advertising, increase our brand awareness, and increase our consumer traffic. So that has been the aim to get to scale. And we now achieved that, I think. And we're at critical mass, as it were. We're a size that we can actually function properly. Having done that, the job now that we're giving a decent return, good leads back to our agents and our advertisers, the job now is to convert the financial side of that and become, you know, profitable business. And that was underway towards the year end, and hence the 30% growth in our revenues. The beginning of the year, we saw quite a strong start to the year. Obviously, COVID has had an impact on that, and I'll come back to that. But in terms of the year to January, strong growth in revenues, mainly in the second half. So we did make losses in the year, but a lot of those losses were in the first half of the year before we started converting people from free to paying contracts. So although we still invested cash during the year, 7 million of cash invested, that was very much invested during the first half. So our cash burn is significantly reduced now. Our revenues and our agent numbers are up. We had 8,000 agents, branches. We always talk branches. 8,000 agent branches underpaying contracts at the end of January. That's now increased to 9,000. You know, so I think we had some good momentum. We got the scale we wanted, and that was the main positive for me from the year to Jan 20. Mm-hmm. We've clearly then come into COVID, and that's had a big impact, you know, a huge impact on the agency market. You know, effectively shut the market for a few months during the strictest part of lockdown. We wanted to support the agents who are facing very difficult times, very challenging circumstances. So actually what we have done is given discounts to agent customers, and that has obviously affected our revenues in the short term. And at the same time, we have obviously not been able to continue to convert people to paying contracts in the same way, continue to recruit. So for a short term, it has had a hit for us. We've managed our own cash position to conserve that through various measures. We've reduced staff costs. We've taken advantage of the Chancellor's furlough scheme. We've also reduced extensively our discretionary marketing expenditure just to conserve cash while supporting the agents with our discount. And that has all achieved what we wanted to achieve in terms of giving discounts to them, but manage our own cash. We are encouraged now that the markets have partially reopened. I think you may be aware on the 11th of May, the government made various relaxations to the rules on social distancing and enabled agents to start working again. Clearly, there are still measures in place and it's not back to normal, but nevertheless, it has allowed the markets to reopen in some form. And actually, we've seen very, very busy markets, and I think agents are enjoying having the opportunity to actually transact again and see some deals go through, because the majority of agents only get paid on completion of a transaction. So for them to get cash, it's been vital that the markets reopen in some form. We've seen since the markets have opened, you know, against the low point, late March, early April, visits to our site are up 260%. Actually, the visits to our site are up over 15% over where we were at the beginning of March before COVID. So there's clearly a lot of pent-up demand, a lot of pent-up interest in transactions, and that bodes well for the immediate short term for transactions for agents. You know, 2 days ago, we had our busiest day ever for leads that we generated and returned to advertisers. And that is all despite the fact that, as I say, we're not really spending much on advertising at the moment, rather channeling that money into supporting the agents through discounts. So I think that shows two things. It shows that there is market appetite, at least in terms of clearing the backlog of transactions that built up, which is good for agents. And I think it also demonstrates that we have achieved that vital critical mass I talked about, because, you know, without the need to advertise, we're still getting very high levels of consumer traffic, very high levels of leads. That demonstrates to me that consumers are actively engaged with our brand, you know, see onthemarket.com as a good source of properties for them to view and look at, and are coming to the, you know, coming to the site organically because they've registered with us, because they like the new and exclusive offering. So I think that bodes well for us.
Yeah, absolutely. You have touched on it as well, going forward for the rest of the year. And of course, you know, your kind of site, it's a lot about tech, how user-friendly it is, and also how sort of visible it is to the public. And at the moment, it's quite visible. So going forward, you know, I mean, you've got the content, like you say, and the eyeballs, but marketing plays a large part in that as well. So what's going to be the spend there, and, you know, what will the role of tech play here?
Yeah, so on the marketing side first, I mean, we'll manage the marketing side you know, we effectively deploy expenditure marketing in line with market conditions. So although things are very busy currently, I think there are still, you know, concerns as to how future months roll out. You know, obviously, we're not yet through the COVID crisis or the impact of it. Once the furlough scheme and other government support measures are withdrawn, what does that mean for the wider macro, you know, economic situation? I think there are still uncertainties facing agents, new homes developers, our customers, and we've got to be very conscious of those and, you know, continually assess the situation. So, you know, we'll be doing that going forward. But I think fundamentally, the property markets in the UK, there is more demand than supply, and therefore, you know, the market will return at some point. You know, we've just got to work with our customers so that we're all best placed to see through the challenging times we're in currently and come out the other side as possible to regain our momentum. In terms of tech, I mean, I think tech, you know, I guess one of the things that the COVID situation has brought home is that actually, you know, things like remote viewings, things like platforms that are 24/7 remote, more efficient, you know, those things clearly have been highlighted in terms of the current situation and the, you know, and the advantages they bring. And I don't think we'll go back to the old world as it was exactly. You know, more and more of those sorts of products and technologies and services, I think, will gain traction going forward. That is a path we had already started down prior to COVID. In December last year, we made a small acquisition in a business whose first product is a product named Techlet. And this is a 24/7 online automated lettings software. And it brings a lot of efficiencies, shortens the process for getting tenants and landlords connected and tenants moved in. And you know, with the efficiencies it means for agency staff time, it enables them to deploy more resources on, you know, new business capture, etc. We think that's a very exciting product. It's very early stage, and that, like everything else, you know, COVID has had an impact in rolling that out. But we see a good future for that and for other sorts of products that can provide added value to our customers. And I think having got the platform now, you know, it's a very powerful platform for distributing the right sorts of products and services that our customers can benefit from.
Yeah. And for you, Clive, what's your aim? What does success look like here? What do you want to achieve here?
I think success for us actually is bringing competition into the UK portals market. It hasn't really been a competitive marketplace for some time, and agents have suffered through the increased fees that they've borne year on year because of that. And if we can introduce that competition, you know, we have a clearly stated strategy that we're not intending to rise our fees. You know, they are sustainably fair fees as our policy. But we see the ability to create value for agent shareholders and financial investors through these additional products and services we just touched on. You know, if we can get scale and with the agent support and obviously as agent shareholders and the shareholding grows, that should hopefully facilitate that. And I think if we can do that, you know, we'll have a very powerful platform. It'll be a profitable cash generative platform, and it'll allow us to invest in new products and services that will benefit us and our investors and our customers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, Clive, well, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making here, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Well, I think the first is that we have achieved scale, and that now gives us the opportunity to capitalize on that. We've got over 9,000 paying branches as at the end of May. They're not all paying full tariff because we've been converting discounts and so on. There's a huge opportunity for growth just to convert those onto full tariff as we provide them ever-increasing value. Likewise, we still have over 3,000 branches that are free with us, and converting them to pay gives also a, you know, very large financial upside. So, you know, those things alone, even without further market share growth, would place us well. On top of that, we have new homes. We're now advertising new homes since September, and that's that can, you know, create a lot of financial upside for us as well. So I think we've got large opportunity to grow market share and market share of paying customers. The second one I'd say is that, as we've been discussing, that platform is one of very few platforms that can distribute widely in the agency community other additional products and services, tech-enabled products and services that they can use to either create efficiencies or generate more revenues for themselves. And we can share in that with them. So I think that platform enables us to pursue a tech-enabled products and services delivery path. And the final point I think I would come back to, because I think it's key, is just our differentiated proposition, the agent support and ownership. You know, ultimately, investors, financial investors benefit because, as I've said, agents are the ones who provide the content to portals and make or break the portals. And the fact that they're invested in us, you know, is motivating them to act and support us. And we hope that will give us a cutting edge going forward. And I think, you know, one other thing to add to that, I've said agents can make or break the portals. The COVID crisis has brought into very sharp focus the balance of power between agents and portals, and some of the price increases that agents have suffered and the reasons why we were brought into the play to bring competition. And I think agents now are actively considering their choices. I think we are starting to see agents defect from the market leader and coming off Rightmove, and ultimately, you know, that will balance the power more equally within the portals market, because if Rightmove, you know, is losing agents and is no longer whole of market, consumers will notice that. The consumers will notice they've got to go to other portals to see the properties they want to see, and over time that will give all of us a much more competitive marketplace in which to prosper.
Excellent stuff, Clive. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin. Good to chat.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dan Betts, CEO, founder of Hummingbird Resources. HUM is ticker there. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Morning, Justin. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we've had a lot of news out recently, and we'll dig into that and get through it and discuss that in a bit. Before we do, as always, if someone's tuning in right now, Dan, and never heard of Hummingbird Resources, could you summarise, please, the company?
Yeah, we are a gold producer with an active mine in Mali called Yanfolila that produces about 120,000 ounces of gold a year. We have a development project in Liberia, and last week we announced the acquisition of another development project in Guinea that we intend to build shortly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you mentioned that. Like I said, very active on the M&A front. And so take us through that then, the thinking behind the Caruso deal, if you could, Dan.
Okay, well, as we've been saying for quite a long time, Justin, with regards to Yanfolila, our strategy is to provide growth through extending the mine life at Yanfolila. And last week we announced some drill holes, which from this season's exploration program, I think are extremely encouraging. And they should help fuel the strategy in that regards to extending the mine life at Yanfolila. But beyond Yanfolila, our strategy has been to grow the company through the development of high margin projects. And over the last few years, we've looked at literally dozens of projects, and Caruso ticks all the boxes. So, I mean, to run through a few of those, The entry price of £10 million in Hummingbird shares represents 9.2% dilution in Hummingbird for a project which can potentially double our output. And inside 2 years, it could see us north of a 200,000 ounce a year producer. You know, that could be a company with a sort of $160 to $180 million of EBITDA inside 2 years that we can fund from existing cash flows and our existing lender, Coris Bank, who's shown support for the project. So I think that's a pretty compelling set of numbers. The process flow sheet design, the region operating environment, the scale of the project, the security profile, all of these things in Guinea. I mean, it's just 160 kilometers over the border from Yamfalila. It offers us a lot of opportunity for synergy and for fast tracking the project when it comes to design and engineering to get us into cash flow quicker. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have the team in place who built Yamfalila and the operating experience, so we can lean off that. And I think having that experience is a massive positive. I think the exploration potential at Karusa is extremely compelling. There are some staggering grades there. And most of all, the grade of the resource is very robust. I mean, fully diluted, we are still coming up with a resource grade north of 3 grams a ton, which is very compelling. So with when you combine all those things together, I think you'd have to go a very long way to find a more perfect second project for Hummingbird.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned the strategy there for Yamfalila, and just give an overview again then of the entire sort of group strategy here.
Well, that's a good question, because I think with all this M&A, I think a bit of it gets lost in the fog. But, you know, our ambition ultimately, if you want big picture stuff, is to build the best gold company we can, a company that we're proud of, that ultimately is a multi-asset producer and a flagship ESG miner of the future. And that will include, hopefully, you know, a number of mines in a range of jurisdictions so that we're diversified in terms of risk. I think the key thing, though, is to be disciplined in selecting these projects and to be focused on the scale and the capital cost and the free cash margins the project will generate so that you're consistent in that message. And I think, you know, if you look at a company like B2 Gold, they've always been focused on the geology and their ability to execute. That's a role model I would aspire to. I mean, I think they've done a fantastic job. I don't think you want to just grow for growth's sake. Absolutely not. But I think with growth, particularly in this environment, and we can come on to that, but I think with growth, you will see a re-rating on a risk basis in the market. You know, you'll trade on a higher multiple because the market will see there is less risk, and ultimately all shareholders will be rewarded for that, I hope, in the future.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with the other part of your portfolio there, Dugbe. It was on your balance sheet, seemingly, you know, no value in the share price of that. And it sort of seems a bit too big for you to take forward on your own. Now, you managed to do this with a deal with ARX Resources. So, you know, how do you see this transaction unfolding, and why is it in shareholders' best interest then, Dan?
Okay, well, good question, Justin. I mean, you're right. We've been carrying Dugbe on the balance sheet for a long time. But we believe absolutely in the intrinsic value and the potential of the project. But we face the reality that if we don't do something with the project, we will lose the license. You know, we have a mining license and they have conditions, and then we'd be faced with a $70 million write-down. We've been saying for a long time that Dugbe has a lot of value, but the market clearly doesn't agree, or it doesn't agree that it has value in Hummingbird, because it ascribes no value in our share price to the Dugbe project. So by trying to separate it out and identify that value separately, we can hopefully unlock the value we see in Dugbe. Now, we've had a data room open for a while, looking for a potential joint venture partner or buyer. Now, you have to remember, with the license and where we are in Liberia, it's costing us circa sort of $2 million a year. And that's a drain on Hummingbird's resources. Mm. To the deal we've done with ARX, I think it's been a little bit misunderstood in the market. It's not 49% of the asset for $10 million. If I can step you through the deal, it's a $2 million non-refundable deposit, which is extremely useful because it allows us to maintain all our maintenance costs and environmental and social contributions in Liberia and start rehabilitations of the road and things like that. There is then $10 million that needs to be spent on an exploration program with the sole purpose of increasing the resource base. So to take the 4.2 million ounces up to a bigger number, and additionally, the completion of a best practice feasibility study which will include obviously lots of drilling to get the resources into reserves, and will cost a huge amount of money. It's very difficult to specify exactly how much, because you don't know how much drilling will be needed. But you know, Hummingbird will be involved in the steering committee, and we will ensure that the work is done to the highest standards. At the end of all of this, ARX earns a 49% interest, and Hummingbird will be able to convert its 51% interest into a 51% interest in the ARX vehicle, which by that time I assume will be listed in Canada. It'll have a separate audience, it'll be a separate company. It's a different type of project to the high grade projects like Jan Vlielen Cruiser that Hummingbird is after, and it will isolate and ring fence value for Hummingbird shareholders that will be hopefully very meaningful by that stage. So we're advancing the project at no cost to Hummingbird, and hopefully it will realise a lot of value. I think it's a deal I'm very proud of.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Well, thanks for the detail there. Okay, Dan, as always here, one final thing. If someone likes the progress you're making here, but it's still not following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list then.
Going to struggle to limit it to three, Justin, at the moment. So inflection point in our strategy has got to be one. You know, we've said we want to become multi-asset producer, and the last couple of weeks news can underpin that strategy, supported by our own production. Caruso is a development project, is extremely high margin. It's a digestible size project for us, and our team's done it before. Dubi is in the hands of a very capable management team, and it will create separate value. And I mean, our strategy is growth. So if you want a growth focused junior that is seemingly very undervalued, if you think we could be a 200,000 ounce producer in 2 years, I think our valuation is compelling. Particularly, final point, if you believe the world is in a difficult place, and there's going to be a lot of capital flight into gold, and gold could be going up, which I certainly believe.
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, if you look at the chart on gold, it's been above, 1,700, and it's ready to move. And like you say there, with all the money, sloshing around the system here, hard assets are where it's at, aren't they? Because, even the Fed said, everyone's saying now, this is not a V-shaped recovery, it's going to be a long, protracted economic downturn, and they're going to have to stimulate massively, you know?
I'm a massive, massive pessimist, I'm afraid, on the market. And the markets have absolutely boomed in the last couple of months, and yet gold is still north of 1,700. And that is a massive, massively powerful message, I think. But who knows? Look, it's the gold price, and we could all be wrong. But that's the strategy for Hummingbird. And if people believe in that growth strategy based on those things, then, that's what we're going to deliver.
Yeah, absolutely marvellous stuff. Dan, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Hugo Stevenson, founder and co-CEO of Induction Healthcare. INHC is the ticker there. Dr. Hugo, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to get you on, and I know it's a very hot area, health tech, but I know very little about your company, and I'm sure people listening know more than me, but for people like me who are new to your company pretty much, could you give us a summary as to what Induction Healthcare is all about, please, Dr. Hugo?
Okay, so basically we are a health IT company that provides software services that assist doctors and healthcare professionals be more efficient with their day. Our customers include hospitals and healthcare providers, and they are seeking ways to actually deliver healthcare more efficiently and provide better care for patients.
Yeah. Well, do you know, at the moment, we've had this, the market sell off, the market rebounds in America. The indices that have bounced have been sort of tech heavy. We know how important and how well tech does. And nothing's more important, I suppose, now that we've become aware of this than COVID-19 is health and health tech. And that's even more important within the tech sector. So that's what your company is. So can you expand upon some of the things you actually do, some of the products you have then, Dr. Hugh?
Okay. So, look, put simply, what we do differently in the health tech area. Traditionally, healthcare organizations have bought software on what we call a monolithic basis. They buy a big platform for many, many millions of dollars. It takes months and years to decide on the right one, and they install that platform at a particular hospital, or a department within a hospital picks a particular platform and they install it for 3 to 5 years. Think about the way that, you know, an ordinary person years ago might have bought a license to a word processor or so on, and then upgraded it every few years. The problem with that approach, though, is that every department within a hospital buys a different solution. Every hospital then buys a different solution. Every healthcare provider buys a different solution. And although each of those solutions does what it says on the box, none of them actually work and talk together nicely. And as a result, a lot of the benefits that we take for granted, that, you know, when someone, for example, might book an outpatient's appointment, that their results might actually be ready, that they, when they turn up to hospital, that their GP may be made aware of that. All of those things that we assume should take place don't actually happen the way that the traditional healthcare market has bought technology in the past. Mm-hmm. We take a very different approach. We basically started with an app called the Induction app, that is providing a service that doctors in the healthcare sector, in the hospital sector primarily, want to use. It saves them time in being able to access and communicate with other doctors within the hospital environment. In fact, it is the most used app in by NHS doctors in the UK. We've got more than 120,000 doctors that are using that app regularly to save themselves time. Mm-hmm. The cool thing basically is, if you use that as a backbone, one of the biggest challenges when you see healthcare technology being deployed is a hospital may buy a technology, but actually getting the doctors and the healthcare providers to use it is actually tricky, especially if it's providing value for the hospital, but not for the individual practitioner. Mm. We've got this backbone app, the Induction app, that healthcare professionals choose to use, and we are either building or acquiring technologies that hospitals and healthcare providers need to use, whether it's managing guidelines, managing outpatient appointments, or so on, and actually bolting them onto that backbone that our 120,000 plus doctors that use our application every day, our platform, are using anyway. And that creates an environment where actually all of these different systems actually talk to each other, and they actually get used by the healthcare professionals that need to use it to make a difference.
I understand. Okay, very interesting. And you recently acquired Zesty. Could you explain this and the strategy behind this?
Okay. So, again, as I said, our backbone is an app that a very large number of doctors choose to use. But alongside that, we are buying or building platforms that are useful to doctors, to hospitals and patients, that can be connected to that. The Zesty acquisition is very exciting. What they've done for a number of years and really started to gain traction is provide a portal that allows patients to actually change, view, confirm their outpatient appointments in hospitals. So many listeners will be used to the idea that they get a letter in the mail from their hospital in the NHS to say that they had an appointment yesterday and the mail was slow and they've only just been notified about it. What Zesty does is provide a means by which patients can actually be notified on the phone. They can opt in to be part of it. They can confirm their appointment, change their appointment to a time that suits them without actually having to call up and wait on hold for long periods of time. So that in itself was very exciting. There's also the ability for information that a patient punches in at the time of either booking their appointment or changing it to actually be fed back to the clinical team that would be reviewing that patient at the outpatient appointment. So, for example, are there some questions that suggest that this patient should be seen sooner? Are there some questions that might suggest that the doctor needs to look at the results before they see the patient or order another test before they see the patient? Being able to join Zesty and the patient booking up to the Induction app that we've got allows that to happen. The second thing, which is also really exciting, is that in order to deliver what Zesty has had to deliver, they've been able to build a connector with the electronic medical record. That's these big systems that hospitals buy to actually store the medical record that used to be done on paper more and more electronically. This integration engine that allows the outpatient booking system to communicate with that EMR now also allows not only our induction app, but also the MicroGuide platform that we bought prior to Christmas to have that integration with the electronic medical record as well too. And that takes the functionality to a completely new level, because now doctors can communicate with the electronic medical record through the induction app too.
Yeah, and is this up and running right now, or is it going to be?
So the integrations that enable that are being developed right now, and we've got a number of pilot hospitals that are actually working with us on that implementation. And that's something that obviously over the first 2 to 3 months of this acquisition, we hope to have up and running and delivering value for the existing customers that we've got.
Understood. Now, I speak to, you know, every company I speak to is listed, and I suppose sometimes I miss the obvious question. I mean, it can apply to everyone, of course, but specifically to you, what are the advantages of being a public listed company then, Dr. Hugo?
So this probably relates to one of my previous companies, Drug Dev, that I ran and founded prior to Induction Healthcare. That was applying a very similar strategy of a backbone and buying and building applications that bolt on, and I can discuss that in more detail. Mm-hmm. But that was a private company. And one of the challenges that we had as we were growing was acquisition of these solutions that we could bolt on to this backbone. One of the challenges we've got in the healthcare environment is the companies we're looking to buy, many of them are small. Many of them have been running for a number of years and delivering an excellent service to 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 hospitals. But they've been struggling to kind of get beyond that sort of 3, 4, 5. They've proven that their solution works, but they sort of struggle to work with the system at a higher level. They're not prepared to actually sell out totally. They still believe in their big dream, and they still believe in the fact that their solution can deliver real value going forward. The ability to be publicly listed allows us to actually complete those acquisitions on a basis of cash and stock. So we had one example prior to Christmas, MicroGuide, that we did on a cash earnout basis. The Zesty acquisition is all stock because the people that believed in Zesty believe in Zesty as part of the bigger picture even more. Mm-hmm. Publicly listed has allowed us to do that. And I think one of the things which has been exciting for me, and that I think often gets missed, particularly in the UK, is the value of AIM as a market. It basically allows investors to get in at the ground level on companies that have got vision and excitement, and at the same time benefit from, you know, the checks and balances that exist, you know, in a listed company as well too, and, you know, with a board like one that we've got that is, you know, extremely experienced and professional. So that's been very exciting for us as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned that Drug Dev. You found that and recently sold it. Are there sort of parallels you can draw between, you know, Induction Health and that? Wasn't that backed by Invesco, is it?
That's correct. Drug Dev basically was and it still exists as its name, a company that provided software for improving the efficiency of the clinical trial process for drug development. And the way that Drug Dev evolved, it began with a backbone, a network of clinical trial doctors around the world. Majority of clinical trial doctors were part of that network. By having a lot of clinical trial doctors that were interfacing with our platform, our system, we were able to then go and buy point solution software systems that could actually bolt onto that platform, that were able to provide value to pharmaceutical clients that needed those systems in order to make their clinical trials more efficient. Whereas traditionally they would buy that point solution and they'd have to then convince the clinical trial investigator to use yet another platform as part of the 20 platforms they need to use in a day. The drug dev approach basically allowed them to get a solution that met their needs, the pharmaceutical company, a solution that met their needs, but it wasn't creating a new platform for those doctors to jump onto. The doctors were able to continue using their core platform that they used every day. Mm-hmm. We've basically taken that same gameplay and we're applying it to healthcare. So we've taken the scarce resource, the healthcare practitioner that is often thought of last when it comes to designing the software, and providing value for them, and then ensuring that the solutions that we bolt on that provide value to healthcare organizations are easy for the doctor to access because they can use it through the app they already use.
Yeah, understood. Very interesting. And finally, Hugo, for people liking the sound of this, the progress you're making, and what you're developing here, but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please?
Okay, so first and foremost, look, particularly in a COVID-19 environment where there are so many challenges facing our economy, the one sector that I think is extremely exciting is healthcare and healthcare technology, because there is no way that our systems can continue to provide the level of healthcare that we expect without the efficiencies that technology can deliver. So if people are interested in healthcare and technology, particularly in the UK, then that is obviously an exciting reason to follow what we're doing. Second one is I've backed this company from the very beginning. Prior to Float, I'm personally heavily invested in it. I believe in this area. I'm a doctor originally. This is an area that I've wanted to fix for a long time. And for 20 years, I've been involved in starting companies and evolving them to a point of maturity. And I've done that very successfully. But this is an area that I've always wanted to come back to and address, you know, where I started from as a doctor. Mm-hmm. So that's the second reason. And I think third of all, we've got a very experienced management team. We're running a gameplay that has worked successfully before. Our vision here is to really make healthcare more efficient, to take advantage of the technology that many healthcare practitioners, doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, occupational therapists have in their hand every day, mobile phone and mobile technology. We want to make a difference, and we know how to make a difference elsewhere, and we know how to create value for our clients and for our shareholders as well.
Excellent stuff. Dr. Hugo, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll have a catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're up, Russ?
Yes, in good health, Justin, you, I hope?
Yes, not too good. Bad. Do you know what? I mentioned you a while back. I jumped in to HSBC. I jumped back out. And yeah. I've decided, I had another look at it. And just even looking, and I say, I find it very hard to go through a bank's, you know, sort of final results and all that.
It's very tricky.
I'm not an expert like you, but I can't really do that. But I just saw HSBC, one of the biggest banks in the world. I looked at the chart, it's an historic low, and on what's called a relative strength index, which is a momentum indicator on a weekly. Mm. It's never been this oversold ever. And I thought, as a contrarian play, I'm going to put my a small toe in, an edge in if I start to see an uptrend. But, you know, I won't risk too much capital there. But I think, you know, I'm looking 2-3 years in the line here. So you've done a piece on banks. What's at the moment, what's your thoughts there?
Well, it's interesting. We picked up on the same thing because natural contrarian. I was trained at a value fund management house, which admittedly means it's been a bit of a scary few years. But I was just intrigued because, you know, American banks, first of all, caught my eye because, you know, the US market's on a barnstorming run. US banks, since the market low on the 23rd of March, up 40%. This was until just before the Fed opens its mouth, so the numbers are down a little bit since.
Yeah.
But US banks up 40%, European banks up 27%, emerging market banks up 23%, Japanese banks up 18%, UK banks down 4%. And so that was like, ooh, why is that? So, I think there are two things. One, you've touched upon the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, which the name's a bit of a giveaway as to one of the reasons why people may be giving it a bit of a wide berth at the minute. It's actually the worst of the performing big five in the FTSE 100 because it's in this terrible political pickle in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
It gets more than half of its profits there. It's given public approval to the Chinese authorities' new security law for Hong Kong as the Standard Chartered Bank. And although that's obviously keeping the Chinese authorities and local regulators happy, it clearly isn't going down very well with American politicians or UK politicians and business people. So they're in a very, very tricky political situation as to trying to keep everybody happy, and they're the meat in a bit of a gristly sandwich there, same as Standard Chartered. The other reason that I think affects all of the UK banks, and Barclays has done the best, by the way, probably because of the investment banking side, where you have seen quite a lot of capital market activity and volatility, and HSBC's done the worst, is another political angle. The regulator has leaned on the UK banks and said, you're not paying dividends, you're not buying back stock. So that knocks a big hole in the investment case, because these things ultimately aren't growing that fast. They operate in a tightly regulated, overbanked, over-indebted, and therefore mature, low-growth market. And the only way they're going to generate growth is by taking more risk, which they probably won't get thanked for.
Yeah.
And the second issue is that not only being told not to pay dividends, but they're actually being told, come on, get out there and provide some support, please. Lend, don't pull the rug. So you're looking at no growth, which is not wildly attractive, potentially more risk, not very exciting in the current environment, and no dividend or yield to compensate you for the risk of owning the paper. So I'm not saying that they've been used as completely political utilities. There is an element, I think, of payback for we bailed you out in 2009. Now pull your finger out, which I think will sit particularly badly with Barclays, HSBC and Standard Chartered, who didn't take government bailouts 12 years ago.
Mm.
But I think the fact that you've got this combination of do as you're told, don't pay dividends, there's not much growth, and you're going to take a lot more risk and be told not, and then we've got all these worries over bad loans piling up, both at consumers and at companies. It's not a great time to be a bank. And then on top of that, you've got the Federal Reserve saying, well, we're not going to raise interest rates until at least 2022. They're clearly going to continue to try and manipulate the yield curve so that the borrowing costs are kept flat, as low as possible for consumers and corporations. And that makes it very hard for banks to make a margin on their loan book. So if you're looking for a perfect storm, I think you've probably found it. So the question now is their value here. And the one thing that the banks have got in their favour is they're all trading at big discounts to net asset value or book value per share. So you can say, well, look, we know it's tough now, but the stocks are downtrodden. They are on the, according to all the Bank of England stress tests, they all pass. They've all got common equity tier one capital ratios in the teens, so they can withstand bad loans, not get into anything like the trouble they got into 12 years ago. And at some stage, they wanted to pay dividends and feel they have the capital strength to do so. They've just been told not to. So at some stage, those dividends may come back. Because I guess that's the bull. And let's face it, they're universally unloved because, as you've correctly identified, their performance has been absolutely shocking. So low valuation, downside protection in theory, and potential to pay dividends. So if you're going to be very brave and very patient, and you think that there's going to be even a half-decent economic upturn, banks might be worth a look, but I suspect they're probably more of a punt than a long-term hold, because we've seen what's happened to Japanese banks over an era of sustained central bank interference in interest rates, yield curves and bond markets. And I know that Japanese bubble was a particularly extreme one, but the Japanese banking index is still down about 90% from its peak, even though the overall index is only down by half. It's just not a great environment in which to be a bank, full stop.
Right, so I'll be hitting the sell button this afternoon then.
I didn't say that necessarily. I think what you are going to have to be is clearly very brave. And the thing is, when you did see the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England start to raise interest rates and the yield curve begins to steepen, the banks perform very well. So I think you might get times when there will be these super-duper rallies when people think, right, the economy's off to the races, the central banks are going to have to actually raise interest rates and we can't. And I think that's when, as an environment, when people will pile into banks and they'll move incredibly quickly because you've seen that in Japan, some mega rallies.
Yeah.
But the long-term danger is too much debt, central banks just can't raise interest rates too much. And heaven forbid, when we come out of COVID, there's going to be another recession or another problem at some stage. That's just the natural ebb and flow of the world. Mm. And rates just aren't going to be able to go up very high because there's so much debt in the system. So I think they're probably, although I know lots of deep value fund managers are into them and think there's great potential there, for me, they're probably tradey, punty stocks, not own stocks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand. And the only reason why, like I said, I've taken a small position in HSBC is because purely contrarian. We said that some of the best performers of the last month have been like these, Carnival Cruises and TUI Travel.
Look at airlines.
Yeah, exactly. So sooner or later, I'm expecting some kind of rally in the banks, you know, and when we, like you say, we get some better data, but how long that data and how long that good data will last, because I just, like I said, we don't know how long this is. At the moment, we understand we're having bad figures because the economy was shut down, but where do we stand, really? I mean, how many people are going back to work? How fast will they go back to work? And so we don't know what the economy is like at the moment, do we, really?
We've all got our opinions, we've all got our best guesses, but I mean, it's something I said to someone yesterday, you know, for all of the Bank of England's models and the diligent and bright people who work there, economics is about choice, and it's people that make those choices, and those choices, dare I say it, are not always rational, and they certainly won't always fit with a very bright Bank of England economist model. Mm. You cannot predict what people do. The Bank of Japan, when it first took interest rates negative 5 or 6 years ago, was convinced the Japanese would just go out and spend money because it would be penalised for holding money in the bank,
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? Sales of safes boomed.
Wow, yeah. People just storing cash.
People literally took it out of the bank, shoved it in a safe in their house.
So
that was not a predictable choice, but it was the one that a lot of Japanese... So the Bank of Japan's model, straight in the ash can, just didn't work. And that's not because a stupid person came up with a model. It's just people did something that you wouldn't necessarily have expected. And that's why economics is fiendish. And that's why second-guessing what's going to happen economically in the second half of this year is hard. Because as you rightly said, even if today the Prime Minister said, right, everybody, it's all clear, we're all done and dusted, we think we're in the good, and you can all go back to work on Monday, how many people would dash back or be able to dash back?
Or be willing
to dash back? This is a very difficult issue. I know lots of people were chafing at the bit to get back.
Yeah.
I know lots of people who aren't sending their kids back to school, even though they can, because they're still concerned, and you can understand why.
And of course, I mean, there'll be companies who are going back to work now with more debt but less customers. So,
that's a difficult situation. And again, I think, you know, at the moment, I'm for other columns that I write for customers and so on, that I'm still generally trying to A, do as little as possible because you're just guessing, and B, I'm still trying to tippy toe my way through it, looking for companies I think have got the financial strength to get to the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
And I think that still, for me, is important. Yes, by all means, if we get a proper recovery, then the things that have been most badly damaged will recover the most quickly, hence your point about airlines and so on. But it's going to be a wild ride. I mean, Delta Airlines is down 20% in 2 days in the States.
Yeah.
And their trading statement yesterday was pretty ugly in that, yes, this old point we've discussed before about the second derivative, when the sales go from down 95% to down 90% to down 85%, markets start getting excited because if it stops getting worse, it's eventually going to get better, right?
Yeah.
But Delta, the rate of improvement's been really slow. Yes, it's gone from down 90, but it's still down 85, 86, not down 50. So people are still being very, very careful in America about flying. And given the spikes you've seen in Texas and California and Florida, again, you know, I'm not sure the Floridian lockdown was a very tight one anyway, but it understandably makes people a little bit nervous. So I think they are the ones that will travel if things get better, but equally they will be the ones that will take the most ferocious drubbing if there's any delay. And you know, look at the VIX. I know it spiked to 38 last night back in the States, but even before the Fed was, you know, pretty cautious on Wednesday and yesterday's rollover, the VIX had not gone back. Yes, the Nasdaq was at a new all-time high, and the S&P was pretty close to its year highs, but the VIX was nowhere near back to the 10 and 12 levels it started the year. It was still in the 20s.
Yeah.
So I think the one thing that we can expect, whether you think markets are going up or down or what, the market still thinks there's more vol coming around the corner, more volatility coming around the corner. And I think what we've seen Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of this week would suggest that's a pretty accurate view.
Yeah, and that means more opportunity to get out or get in. It's up to you.
There you go.
Exactly. Marvellous. Russ, have a nice weekend,
Pat. Keep well.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst and full-time investor. You all right, fella?
Yeah, morning, Justin.
Now, a big sell-off in the markets yesterday. It was at 1,800 points on the Dow, which was almost close to 6%. People started to worry. And we did hit, you know, the Nasdaq has rallied like crazy, of course, but it's the constituents pretty much that make up that make it rally. But it's a bounce today in the markets. And I just think, at the moment, it's very odd, because we don't know where we are economically. Nobody knows. We big jobs numbers coming out, you know, last year's. This week, especially in the UK as well, even Centrica alone, 5,000 yesterday. But like I said, we don't know when we open back up. Nothing's going to open up straight away and like full tap on, is it? It's like I said, it's slowly going to get back to normal. But so I think that, you know, we're going to have a lot more volatility. That's all I can guarantee. We'll have a lot more volatility. And as I said to Russ Mould actually earlier, that gives you opportunity to either get out or get in. It's up to you. You know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's no doubt about it. There's a lot of algos and a lot of computer programs who run on sentiment. They do web scraping. And as soon as they hear sort of negative news, and Jerome Powell on Wednesday night came out with some pretty sort of darker than expected sentiments. He was sort of pouring cold water on this V-shaped economic recovery in the States. And that was slightly taking the wind out of the sails, out of the bulls, because they are hoping that it will be. And then you obviously had a bit of a pickup in infection rates in places like Arizona and Texas. And so people were just sort of like, you know, some negative on the, you know, on the news wires. And I'll tell you what happens. I mean, 60% of most trades, particularly in the major indices, in the futures markets there, are just simply computers. And what happens is they hit a sell button or a buy button, and because, you know, they buy all of the stocks because that's how they work, then all of them go down. And you had a very indiscriminate sell-off yesterday. Okay, admittedly, you know, your big sort of Apples and your Microsofts went down by 5%, and your hotels or your airlines went down by 15%. So giving you a blend of about, I can't remember, 7%, I think it was, on the Dow. But the key to me is if you're feeling stressed and you want to give yourself a gauge of whether this is serious or not, have a look at the bond market. And if you go on to sort of like one of the best websites I use is the Bank of, I can't remember which one, it's Fred anyway. It's one of the big
Federal
banking
Reserves,
ones.
Federal Reserves.
And look at the BBB yield on corporate bonds, and if that is not moving or it's pretty flat, then just go and have a cold bath or a beer or something, because it isn't a major problem. The thing which brought it whole market down at the start of the year was obviously the medical crisis, but the bond market went absolutely nuts and hit the roof, and that really meant that all these margin calls got absolutely, you know, taken out by their knees, and put them huge amounts of stress and distress selling.
What are people looking for? What are you looking? They look at the bond market. What are people looking for there?
If
no one knows what the bond market's all about, what do you look for?
Look at the yield. The yield at the moment, it's at effectively on a 3 or 4 month low, and it's on about, I think it was 2.76. I looked this morning.
The yield of which bonds? Which bond are you looking at?
The U.S. corporate bonds, BBB, okay. And it's on that Fred website. If you just do a search on it, but that's the main gauge. Because, and the reason why I picked BBB, you can trick any of them, but the BBB is a good one because it's the lowest level of investment grade, one notch above junk, and therefore it gives you a good one-shot indicator if there's any stress in the bond market. Because what happens is such that if you get real concern, people then think they're going to flip over from that company's going to flip over its debt in from investment grade to junk, and then it becomes a real problem for them to raise new money through their banking, and their credit rating deteriorates, plus their interest rate goes up as well. So that's the best sentiment gauge at times of ultimate stress. Yesterday, it was having a walk in the park. It didn't move. In fact, I think it was flat or even went down, whereas everybody else was in the equity markets was just tearing the hair out.
Yeah, but is it always that case, though? Like I said, we still don't really know, do we? We still don't really know how the economy is going to look. And what's worrying
is... But the point is, that's not an indicator of the economy. What I'm trying to say, it's the indicator of the stress. So if you think that yesterday, which a lot of people did, was going to be, oh my God, here we go again. It's going to be a 30% down, drawdown, yeah? Have a look at the bond market, the yield on the bond market, because if that's calm, it means it isn't. It's going to stabilize and it's likely to come back. If that had spiked 2 or 3% from 2.76% to like 4.5% or 5%, then that thesis that we're actually going to go further down and faster would well probably played out. So that's the key.
Doesn't that reflect on itself, though? I mean, if the markets get volatile, doesn't it tick up a little bit on that? And then does it both feed into each other?
Not really, no. You usually find the yield, the bond markets go first. In the corporate debt, those corporate... Triple B is a pretty damn good indicator of whether there's a proper sustainable stress in the going to be sustainable in the equity markets. I'm not saying that there's not going to be stress in the equity markets. I'm just saying whether it's going to be sustainable. Because what it does, it basically says, our company's going to go bust, yeah? And if it spikes up, it says more of them will do. Hence, will cause a contagion in the banking sector, in the shadow lending sector, and also just generally the equity goes down because it's further down the capital structure. So that's the if I was gonna just put out one KPI that people want an indicator of whether it's sustainable stress in the equity markets. Have a look at the yield on the triple B corporate debt. It spiked like anything at the beginning. In March, it went from about 2% to 7 or 8%, and it's steadily been coming down, and it's its lowest level since pre-crisis.
Do you see what I find odd? I mean, what weight do you apportion to job losses, though? I mean, do you see that as a factor? Because it's very interesting. And in fact, Thursday and Friday, I look at that Federal Reserve, I look at that and I get the figures for the Federal Reserve's asset balance sheet. And also I look at the job figures in America. And oddly, the balance sheet of the Fed dropped. They only expanded their balance sheet last week by $3.7 billion. That's down almost 95% from the week before, which is down from the week before. And like I said, if you go back to mid-April, they were spending $500 billion. And so they're down to 3.7 billion yesterday. And we had a big fall off there. I know it's a lag factor. The fact that they're there now, stopped propping up the market a little bit, and that the market falls off the cliff after Jerome Powell, it's a bit of a coincidence. But what I found really a bit worrying is that jobless claims in America, even though initial jobless claims are coming down, the continued claims haven't come down that much. So we're still at 20 million now. The maximum it went to was 24 million, and now it's down at 20 million. That's a big number still, isn't it? People claiming in America. And so, to me, the things I think we have to look at, and I think it's quite important, is how many of those get back to work and how quickly. That's what I think. That will show whether we've got any growth coming back to the markets at all, on a corporate level. I understand Wall Street's different to Main Street, but that surely is something the Fed can't... Well, they can try and help it in some way, but if that stays very high, that unemployment figure, that's going to have a knock-on effect, surely.
You're a pretty hard taskmaster or person to please, because push the clock back to 1:29 p.m. last Friday, a minute before the US jobs report came out. The world was expecting 10 million jobs lost in May. Oh, sorry, 8 million jobs lost.
Yeah.
8 million, yeah. And we got a 2.5 positive.
That was odd, wasn't it? And in fact, did you see the statement that saying they may be at the bottom? There was in this small print saying there may be an error here, So they,
there always
so,
is. It's never right. Yeah. It's just a first shot. But all I'm saying is that it was over 10 million better than people had expected. Mm. And now you're saying it's such that, oh, you know, is that going to be enough? And all the kind of ways, look, you've got to, what I say is you've got to basically look at it at incremental. It's, we had a massive, massive, effectively pat on the back for the economy at the end of last week because people's expectations.
Okay, so you're bullish now. Hang on, are you bullish?
I was bullish last week, and all I would say is that, you know, it's going to be tough. Everybody knows it. If it gets tougher, what I found was quite interesting was such that when Jerome Powell came out with his negative view on or less, he said, look, we're not going to get a V, which is probably fair dues, no doubt about it. If you could read that as such that actually bad news is good news, because what he's doing is laying the ground for another third stimulus package. And if you actually look at sort of like a lot of the news wires from some of Congress members, they're all saying we need another massive $2 trillion.
Yeah.
Exactly. And if you get that, we're talking helicopter money again. It's going to be raining dollar bills.
Yeah.
So in that case, if you get bad news, we've got the financial firepower to get through it. The key to it is, and we come back to it, you know, quite a few times, I guess, is can we get through the second wave? The increase in infection rate is absolutely no surprise, shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, because if you start opening up the economy, you get more contacts and therefore you're going to get more, you know, people who unfortunately going to catch it and go back to and go into hospital, which is what's occurred. But the key is, are we going to get through it? And the level of fatalities and hospitalizations, if we are going to get through it, the level of fatalities and hospitalizations, are they going to cause a political issue? And actually, I'll tell you what would cause a political issue is if the government here or Congress or Washington put everybody back into lockdown, because people have just had enough of sitting at home, regardless of the fatality rate. And yes, there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, they've been, you know, Walt Disney shouldn't open its theme park out in Florida and they're having a petition and all this sort of stuff. But equally, you've probably got 75% of the population who just say, look, bring it on. You know, if we're going to go through this. So what that tells to me is that politically, sentiment for the voters is such that the vast majority of people want us to effectively get through it and are able to stomach an increase in the maximum level of fatalities and hospitalizations that we had back in you know, April and May. And on that case, you know, we're not going to go back into lockdown. Yes, it might be longer and it might take, you know, a bit tougher than a V-shaped. But in that, to bridge the gap, governments have already said what they're going to do. I mean, you know, do you like it or not? Because it's yours and mine and taxpayers' money being used here. Well, we haven't got any choice. We voted these guys in and they've said, you know, we're going to basically stand by the economy and spend and rain dollar bills and pound coins on everybody, which is what's happened. And they're going to
But they have to do that. I mean, I don't know if you heard Stephen Mnuchin yesterday, who's the Treasury Secretary, I think, but he said, whatever happens, there's going to be no lockdown again. So, you know,
there you go.
So, and part of me thinks, let's be honest, if you look at the stats, it's generally the most affected people are above 60 with health conditions.
Yes.
And at what level can we just get on with it anyway and shield those people and track and trace, which is what we have to do, a bit more sophisticated on that, get that up to speed, antivirals, all that stuff.
What would happen if we get a vaccine, you know, good vaccine news on Monday? It will rocket. People go, you know, fantastic. Or alternatively, you know,
it would be very surprising if you got one on Monday.
I was being sarcastic. But in terms of, you know, antivirals, I don't know if you saw it yesterday.
The only place I'd come from is China, and I wouldn't believe them at all. We've got one. We can sell it to you all. We created the problem, and we've got the solution. That's the mother invention. Yeah.
But if you've noticed, and you probably have, because you're a man on the data, one of the key lead biotech businesses out in the States, Regeneron, its shares hit an all-time high yesterday as the market went down. That says to me, you know, that actually their antibody and antiviral therapeutic is actually making very good progress. And that's a cocktail of that. What they do is they take plasma from a person, usually probably know, take plasma from a patient who's actually recovered, synthesize which antibodies they were, they then basically synthesize it chemically, put a cocktail sale of those antibodies back into the body. And then if you catch or, you know, you catch the coronavirus, it then effectively kills off the, you know, the actual disease itself. And if that happens, and it seems to be getting a lot of, I mean, you know, this is the one thing that Dr. Scott Gottlieb, that sort of like, you know, the ex-FDA guy, the medical chap, the sort of the kingpin out in the States, he's sort of said, he's the one, he's really been backing this for 3 months, and he says it's our best hope of bridging the gap to a proper vaccine. And it looks as though, you know, Regeneron shares are, you know, they're all-time high, which says to me they're making good progress in that. And if we get that regardless of a vaccine, we're absolutely there.
Yeah.
So all I would say, put it into perspective, we've come a long way very quick. We had a 7% drawdown yesterday. And yes, it felt horrible. Everybody lost a lot of money. As I say, have a look at the bond markets. If they're not going, they're not screaming that there's a problem, just, you know, take your foot off the sell button. Just take, you know, basically stay, remain calm and keep positions. If that bond market flies up, then you need to have a look at the foot to see whether this is actually going to be a problem. It didn't do anything yesterday, so we're fine. I'm happy. I've got no problem. All we do is it's been a trash rally. Those stocks which fell the most flew, you know, basically then rose the most and then flew down the most yesterday. And when you get a spike in infection rates, particularly in places like Arizona, where majority is being caused by effectively being transmitted in air conditioning, then that says to me things like cinema chains, bars, cruise ships, airlines, anything where you're going to have, where they're going to have a lot of people in a small area under aircon, is probably going to come back, you know, take longer to come back than you think.
Okay, and have you been buying anything? Are you bullish on anything? Have you had a level of cash last week? And for someone who's bullish, though, you're taking your time on getting in back into the market.
I'm patient.
That's good, though. Do you know what? I always find, you know, if I make any mistakes generally, it's because I've been too enthusiastic, I've jumped in too quickly, and there's always pretty much more opportunity down the line. Like, that's the thing with markets. It always provides opportunity. And if anything, my biggest downfall is getting too enthusiastic and jumping in too soon, you know?
Yeah, well, you can move. I mean, I do. I mean, I fall into the same trap. You know, I don't think everybody does. I tend to buy too early and sell too early, but I make a margin in between, and it's usually a very good one, so I've got no problem. In terms of sort of like, you know, my stance, I'm still, you know, relatively bullish. I'm still looking for, you know, opportunities. My cash position, if I include my house, is roughly around about 47% as it currently stands. And I've got, you know, sort of like, and then my equities.
We spoke about this yesterday. I mean, cash position including your house. So, because I don't look at it like that. I just, obviously, you said it's an asset class, of course. So, you can obviously. But it's illiquid, though. You can't sort of liquidate that and put that in. So when you look at your stockbroking account, what amount of cash, what percentage cash do you have there?
Okay, well, if you take my house out...
How does it fit in there? How small is your house? How do you fit that in your account?
Oh, yeah, I'm in a Wendy house, mate. Okay, it's probably a 60-40 split in cash.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's about slightly less than 60-40, 55-45, something like that, of cash. So I'm still heavy on cash. But anyway, my sort of like line of sight is to increase my equity position on a selective basis. And the areas that I'm looking for primarily are good, you know, GARP stock. So it's technology. And I really want to actually increase my exposure in healthcare and biotech and medicine. But the prices are pretty rich at the moment. And I increased in the technology and the software space this week. I mean, I mentioned, and you heard it here first 2 weeks ago, I said I was quite, you know, bullish on Rosslyn Data Tech, that ticker RDT, and I was having a really good sort of like look at it. And then what I needed to do was to go and have a chat to one of the fund managers to see whether he was interested in selling. And I managed to contact one earlier in the week and did a cross trade, a block trade off market. Well, it was on market, but essentially we agreed it at a price and how many shares, not through a normal brokerage account. And then we just conducted that on Wednesday. So I managed to pick up all my shares that I wanted in Rosslyn at that time. And I'm very happy because it's software as a service. 80% is recurring revenue streams. Great blue chip customer base. it's a it's
so they raised a big chunk of money, didn't they? You, now you say growth, you know, at a reasonable price, but right there, if I look at the, I know it's a historical document. If I look backwards, I understand they're using the money primarily to increase, you know, their sales and grow the business. As yet, there isn't growth there, though, is there?
Yeah, but you asked that question 2 weeks ago, and do you remember what I said?
But they're going to invest in growth, aren't they? That's what they're saying.
No. Did you not remember what I said?
You said they're getting rid of lower margins. The revenue, the top line's gone down. But
they deliberately decided not to progress very low margin business that is really passed through, and so you started from a lower base. Now the point is, if you're a corporate,
which but are they confident of growing that their margin?
I'm just trying to explain that to you. As in, like, if you're a corporate, which they sell to, so they sell to the likes of, you know, basically Coca-Cola, Heineken, all these Coors and Vitties and all these kind of really fantastic brands. So it's all big blue chip companies. If you're one of these guys and your customer base is stretched, you're looking at your costs, yeah? So it's 40% of this business is basically spend analytics. It's to help them reduce their costs. The other side is the big data supply chain analytics, which again will reduce their raw material costs, it will reduce their supplier management costs, it will reduce their working capital, and it will also reduce their overheads. It is in the perfect sweet spot to help their customers reduce their cost base, which is frankly what they need to do. And so they should do well. Now, let's just assume, worst case, they don't grow at all, which are frankly, I think the market's growing at 15% per annum. And if they don't grow at all, I'll be a bit disappointed. But even so, the shares are priced at such a low level, it makes no difference. But let's just assume, really negative, they don't grow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened to AlecoSoft or Aleco, as we talked about it 2 weeks ago? Their revenues went down by 3%. What happened to their profit? It went up by 25%. So what we're saying here is that those companies who haven't really had a major impact from COVID, even if they don't grow, because they're not basically exhibiting at these trade shows, they're not flying around the world, they're not having to spend on marketing, they're not having to go to hotels and all this sort of stuff, their profits are going through the roof. Their margins are just doing so. These guys, you've got better either way. They save their customers a shed load, so they should be essential. They should grow because it's a growing market, big data and spend analytics. If they don't grow, their margins are going to increase. I've been struggling to work out. Okay, they're small, and everything is small means, or relatively small, everything in that case, you've got to put it with a speculative eye. However, you know, this is my kind of bread and butter stuff. It's small cap, it's software, it should grow. And, you know, it's just done a fundraise. So it shouldn't have any problems in terms of, if it goes through a wobble or has a problem with a customer, then it'll be able to get through it without having to do any more fundraise. It's got so much cash it could fund itself for about 5 years without any revenue. So, you know, it's got no problem, not quite that. I mean, that's a bit of exaggeration, but it's got sort of like well over 5 or 6 million of cash as of today.
Mm-hmm. I know I'm
being perhaps a bit too bullish there, but I think so. Anyways, software is an area that I want to get into. Medical.
No, I understand. Listen, a recurring revenue software is very, you know, that's the place to be. You know, every company pretty much who have a product want to try and, you know, get that recurring software as a service business going, don't they? So, you know, and
but especially where your product saves your customers a lot of money when they need to improve their efficiency and productivity. This is the thing that they do. I mean, in times of strife, who takes the helm really in decision making on the board? It's the finance director, because it's basically cost management and cash management. These guys do it perfectly for them.
I like lots about this company. I like it, and I've been reading, you know, the update. Like I said, the fact they raised that amount of money compared to their market cap at
a 22% premium.
Yeah, at a premium. So it says either they got a cracking guy who can sell there. He can sell the story. He's got the gift of the gab. I don't know who's in charge of that. No, because you see, I talk to CEOs, right, and some of them have the gift of the gab, and they basically sell you straight away, and you've got, they've got you, and I'll invest in them, because I just thought, if they can talk to me like that, they can talk to others like that. And they, you know, but sometimes they underdeliver though, and they overpromise, underdeliver. The best combination is someone who can, you know, actually talk the story and actually deliver as well. So yeah. The fact is, they've raised the money. They've got a good, decent business, and they say their net proceeds of the $6.8 million will be used by the company for the following purposes. Number one, increase sales and marketing effort to accelerate growth. So that's, you know, that's I'm assuming they've got it in place, everything's sorted in, they just want to accelerate that growth. And of course, you've got to think, well, if a guy can sell that kind of placing, surely he can sell to other people, you know? So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, all I would say is that, you know, my hit rate is about 61%, okay? So I'm wrong 39% of the time. So if anybody decides this, they like it, but don't do it. Do it because you want to do it, not because I'm
Listen. I mean, every now and again, you get an imbecile. Blame me or someone on the podcast for them making an investment decision. I said, yes. This is not the point. The point of this podcast is it's information. You use that information to do what it's your money, it's your stockbroker account. You know, you press the buy and sell buttons. And I always say the worst investors in the world are people who blame other people, you know, and make your own decisions, do your own research, and be responsible for your own money. It's your money. I didn't hack into your account and press buy. You are pressing buy. So, be responsible for it, you know, and be responsible if the share price goes down as well. It's your money. I know most people understand that. 99% of people who listen to this podcast and get the odd 1% who try and blame other people. Like, if you blame other people, you will never learn from that loss, ever. Yeah. And that's the best lesson I ever get. When I lose money in stocks, it's you learn so much from that, you know? And that's the way to get better at investing, isn't it?
You're talking my language. I totally agree.
Mm. Anyway, okay. Listen, one more thing. We both chatted to Rightmove, which is the big player, of course, the dominant player, the big dog. Rightmove in that market, the online portal sort of real estate and sales and letting. We talked to Clive Beattie, who's acting CEO. Both of us, who did video, I did a podcast for On the Market. And do you know what I said to Clive? What I sort of like about this is owned by the sort of agents, or they have a cut of it, you know, estate agents. And Rightmove is coming in for a lot of flack. They're charging what, £1,500, £1,000, you know, per month. And some of them are just boycotting Rightmove and moving over to On the Market. But when I was driving along a while back, and I only ever had Rightmove app on my phone, and I said to Clive, do you know what convinced me to put your app on my phone? And I said, I don't know if it's true or not, but I heard it on the radio in an advert, that you get instructions faster than any other player because letting agents, it's not contractual, or they decide to upload to your site before anyone else's. And I said, and that's, when you're house hunting, you know, you've got a safe search pretty much. You've got properties there. I've seen those. I like that one. I'll save that one. But essentially, you're looking for something else, and you want to, as soon as a new property comes online in your brackets, in your search criteria, you want it to see it first. You know, you'll be the first to go and see it, or you want to see it. And so, if you've got that over Rightmove, that's a huge, bit of a weapon in your armory. And he said, no, it's true, we've got that, they don't have that. Everything else, if we improve our tech in some way, someone can copy it, you know. But that, because we have agreements with all the lettings agents, they'll just do that, they'll upload it to ours first. And so I love that. But I mean, as yet, there's still sort of a disruptor, there's still burning cash, but what's your thoughts on
I'm totally with you. I mean, I think, you know, when you come to select stocks, if you just stand back and you look at On the Market, the uniqueness of that content that you've just described, giving people 24-hour access across their, you know, to get into a house or to have a look at a house before the likes of Rightmove or Zoopla or Prime Location is a key differentiator. And is to say, you know, if you take a sort of like a big deep breath and you look at looking for sort of differentiators, USPs, stuff that is really going to stand out in the crowd, then you've spotted it. I mean, I had the same chat, and, you know, I think that's a real sort of draw, no doubt about it. However, you know, when you look at the actual financials, and it didn't really come out of the actual statement, but you look at the momentum in the business, their revenues were up 32% last year. This is pre-COVID, so yes, you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. But that's, you know, that's what it was, up to £18.8 million. But if you just backward engineer that and look at it, the first half versus second half growth, first half growth was, what was it, 14%. Second half growth, 50%, like-for-like organic growth. Now, what will they do going forward? Well, they've taken their guidance away. Yeah. Mm. Rightmove are saying effectively this year they're going to get their revenues are going to decrease. However, on the market, their revenues are actually going to, I think, this is my view, I think they're going to increase. And the reason why they're going to increase is because it's going to be a first half, second half thing. Okay. They give their estate agents a discount to get them through the COVID crisis in H1. So it'll be tougher for the first 6 months. But I think the housing market is coming back. Just look at what, you know, the statistics which came out. There was a report on Tuesday saying that demand, admittedly pent up, at the current level, the first week of June, was 54% higher than it was pre-COVID. So what's happening is that it's coming back faster than anybody thought. You've got a deluge of potential house buyers wanting to do it. Their positioning, their, you know, when you look at the first half, second half, they nearly made a, you know, they weren't that far off making an EBITDA profit in the second half because they made all the losses in the first half. And, you know, I reckon, this is my view, they are going to break even at roughly around about £25 million, okay? And but they're not going to lose with their terms of cash management. They'll probably be a million down this year, something like that. You know, so because they'll basically not, you know, they'll reduce their marketing spend and reducing their overheads. It's what we've talked about with software companies. You know, they can do this. They basically don't spend as much and therefore cut their cloth. So what happens is such that they're going to get through this void of COVID-19. The shares at 57p today currently trade at 1.7 times EV sales. If you assume sort of next year's earning, well, next year's level, or even on historical, if you look at last year's as well. So it's, we're not talking, you know, sort of like a rich valuation for a software company. Rightmove, in comparison, is on, well, last year's numbers, 17 times revenues. And it's over 20 if you look at this year's numbers. When Zoopla was bought by the private equity house Silver Lake in May 2018, they paid 8.4 times sales. And even if you look at Money Supermarket, which isn't in the same vertical but is a portal, is on over four times sales. So this is really well priced. In my view, it isn't going to have to raise any more money. And if it does, and I think it will get through this COVID valley, you know, this could re-rate very, very rapidly. It could go from a 1.7 times sales to, you know, sort of like a 2 to 3 to 4. Once it has that path to profitability, and I think the path is there, they're going to get there in 18 months. You know, not this year, calendar this year, but certainly next year in 2021, these guys should be profitable. And on that basis, that rating is going to happen. So it's right. I mean, I was really impressed when I spoke to, like you, I spoke to Clive Beattie, and it's right on my stock watch list, I can tell you. And I would say, if anybody who is a, like me, a sort of patient, risk tolerant type of small cap investor, have a good look at it, put the slider all over it and break down first half, second half, and what they're going to do when they get through into 2021, because the power and the operating leverage of this thing is pretty damn immense.
Yeah. Well, do you know, that's the one thing I've had it. I didn't watch this for a while. I spoke to the last CEO actually, but it must be 18 months ago. And I looked at it. I thought, well, you're just burning a lot of cash, you know. And there's no mention of profitability then. And I thought, you're just burning a lot of cash, and anyone can burn cash and pay for web views, pretty much, you know. But they have got the content, like I said. They've got these agents on board now. I think they said about 18,000 agents in the country, and they've got sort of a third of them pretty on board.
That's correct. Yeah.
And.
So or two-thirds. They've got two-thirds.
Yeah, they've got that end of it. But what I liked is now, they did mention that, like I said, whenever I look at their loss-making company, I always look at, I want them to be within 12 months of almost getting to profit, because otherwise they just keep diluting you all the time. It's pointless. And so I want at least them to put a line in the sand, you know? And if they don't, if they fail to do it, at least then you can sort of hang them on it and say, listen, you said this, you stated this. So yeah, I like the fact that they mentioned for the first time, I think, ever in their results that their goal is profitability, you know, and they're going to get there. So I quite like that, yeah. So like I said, it's it can go up and down at the moment. It's a long way off yet. But yeah, definitely one to watch out for, because this is an anti. People, agents hate Rightmove. They hate it. you know. So because they just basically charge them loads of money, but they've got to, it's one of the things, it's a necessary evil, they've got to have it because it's a dominant player. But sooner or later there'll be a tipping point, like you say, for on the market, and hopefully they'll get there, you know.
And then, and if they decided to actually tune down their marketing spend,
can they do that though? Can they do it? I mean, if the very brand awareness is very good, I think, for on the market, you know. Can they do that? Can they tune down?
They can. Yeah, I mean, I've got no, you know, I think they can. You just got to be, what you do is, you, when you first start up in the first 2 or 3 years, you find out which works, and then you get a number of sort of, like, you know, once you get the brand recognition, then you get a number of repeat coming through to your, you know, your potential portal. So yes, it's sort of like refining and getting most value from where you put your branding dollars. I mean, there's a, I mean, I used to work for Unilever, and there used to be a saying in the business, if I could only stop spending the 50% of marketing that I don't, that doesn't, that drives me, you know, no value at all, then we'd be doing really well. And this is the same thing on the web. You know, it's a matter of getting cuter and learning more and more about, you know, the what's the greatest value. So they can do that on an emergency, but I don't think they need to do it anyway. They've got enough money. It's all, I would say, it's a very, I hadn't really, you know, cast my eye over it before, but I came away feeling, actually, this has got potential opportunity and upside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you seen the margins on Rightmove? It's nuts. 70% margin. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It's totally printing money, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Marvellous, Paul. Thanks for that. And we'll speak you next week.
Yeah, thanks, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Vodafone Group, that's VOD. At four, Bahamas Petroleum. Vodafone's up 1% to 127. Bahamas Petroleum at 4, up 13% to 2.95. At 3, it's totally non-mover, 20 pence. At 2, Seeing Machines, down 6%, 2.77. And at 1, it's Non-Standard Finance, NSF, ticker there. That's down 3% to 12.28 pence. All right, top 5 most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, it is Vesarion, Investor Communication. At 4, European Metals Holdings, response to voluntary tender offer. At 3, Games Workshop, trading statement. At 2, Angus Energy, sat fleet by planning update. Okay. And at 1, it's Hummingbird Resources, actually directed dealing. And of course, I chatted to Dan on the podcast today. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.